This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com, and welcome to the fourth week in our month of Boo. During this month of Boo, we have been visiting with a lot of people who are not necessarily your typical magicians that we normally talk to each week here on the Magic Word Podcast. But it's something I thought is an area that many people have an interest in and would like to explore, and some people might want to pursue this. And I know some others actually who do this. So there is a large group of people around the world who find seances and this kind of spooky stuff pretty interesting. And so I hope that you enjoy it. And I try to appeal to a little bit of everyone by having a variety of artists, a variety of people, I should say people with a variety of interests and different styles of entertainment, of whether you're working with cruise ships, trade shows, children's shows, you're working for corporate parties or college circuits, whatever, kind of cover a little bit of everything. Plus, of course, we talk to those people who are involved with collecting, and it doesn't matter whether you're collecting posters, playing cards, or whatever it happens to be. If it has if an interest in magic, I'm sure that we have talked with many of you and people who have been representatives, I guess, of particular areas that I think are of interest to most of you. I hope that you continue to enjoy these various types of guests we have from week to week. This particular one is a little bit different yet as well. But let me point out that my guest today, Albert Lucio, is someone who is very well adept at playing cards. And in fact, he is, I think, one of the better card workers and performers I know, who is really talented. In fact, he has a regular card group that meets here in Austin, Texas each month, in which on Saturday morning, we would go to the library and several of us would exchange ideas, and he always seems to make things better with his ideas and showing us some really good stuff from some of the books that he's read that are more arcane that I haven't gotten around to yet. That proves that he is a magician, and this week he's going to prove that he is also someone who is interested in the arcane arts, I guess I should say, someone who is interested in seances, and in, I mean, in a serious way. This week's episode is really kind of a deep dive into spiritualism. During our conversation, I just let Albert speak because he has such a depth of knowledge about this subject. I just thought it was fantastic, and it's like going to spiritualism school, I guess, or seance school. So for some of you who might be interested, again, in conducting your own seances, or for those who do already, I think if you listen to this episode, you'll get some information that you might want to use kind of as a backfiller, and also some knowledge that you should have when you do seances, because you'll have questions from some of your sitters who are coming to experience and enjoy the seance. Well, Albert is from Austin, and the motto for the city is Keep Austin Weird, and he certainly does that in spades, pun intended. So please welcome my guest here this week, Mr. Albert Lucio, here on The Magic Word. Today we're going to be talking about seances, and we spoke a little bit last week with a gentleman who does seances aboard the Queen Mary, and seances are done all over the world for that matter, but I just thought it would be kind of interesting to highlight a few people from time to time, since it is the month of Boo here in October, to try to get some interesting conversations with interesting people, and since I now live in the Austin area, and their motto is Keep Austin Weird, so it's important that they have seances here as well. But they don't have them just in here, even though it's austinseance.com. The gentleman I'm going to talk to also does seances around the country, basically. We're going to be talking about that right now. So please welcome my friend, Mr. Albert Lucio. Hey, Albert.
Hello. Thank you for having us. This is a good, fun conversation on seance.
I think it should be. How long have you been doing seances, by the way?
So Jake and I started doing seances. Jake is my seance partner.
Jake Cordero.
Yeah, Jake Cordero and I have been doing seances since we started in 2015. But that's a really kind of the preparing and kind of testing out and seeing exactly how we wanted to conduct the seances. And 2016 is when we first did our first public seance. Uh-huh. Since then, we've done probably over 400 of them, and we have sold out pretty much every sitting that we've had for the last 8 years.
And you do them throughout the year, not just around October, too,
right? That's exactly right. People think you just can only do seances in October. We do them in January, March, April, May, June, July. We've done them in 90-degree weather under tents. We've done them in 38-degree weather in sheds. We've done them all over the place.
I just wouldn't think that December during the month of Christmas would necessarily be something which is more of a joyous kind of a thing. It would be a time for people to have seances. But on the other hand, they're probably wanting to talk to some loved ones who have passed during the holidays.
Yeah, well, I think a big part of it is just having an experience.
Yeah.
And so people find that this is just an interesting, different kind of experience.
Yeah. Why'd you get into that then to begin with?
So my background is in sociology and psychology. That's what my degrees are in. Mm-hmm. And I am super fascinated and always been fascinated with things that go bump in the night and since a child. And it's only grown into adulthood. And so my kind of interest has always been in why do we experience the supernatural? How do we experience it? How's it influenced us as individuals, and how has it influenced us as a culture? And so that's really what my interest is in doing the seances.
As a culture within the American audience in general, or worldwide?
I mean, it's really? Worldwide seances had a huge impact on us culturally. We don't talk about it in the textbooks.
No.
But I'm sure you've had people mention some of the facts, like Mary Todd Lincoln had seances in the White House.
Right.
But so did Abraham Lincoln. And so did other presidents have seances in the White House.
Gerald Ford's wife also have some?
Yeah, I think they may have talked to an astrologist.
Yeah.
But it was Reagan's wife.
Nancy Reagan.
And then there's also culturally, the movement of spiritualism was arm in arm with the movement of women's suffrage, with the abolition of slavery. Like these were big movements. And not only that, but about a third of the people in the United States between 1848 is when the movement of spiritualism kind of started. And well, it really kind of got its fire under us because it kind of started a little before that, but it sort of got its fire with the Fox sisters all the way until about the early 1900s. You have about a third of the people from the United States who identified themselves as a spiritualist.
I remember talking to Doc Hilford and some other people, Bob Cassie and others, who have said about how that the spiritualism movement is still going on, even in modern day. Apparently down in Florida, there is a big, I wouldn't say cult, but there's a city, there's a town, I guess, it's kind of like, you know, Ringling Brothers has the circus down there, that they've also got some spiritualism hub.
New York has Lilydale.
Oh.
And there still is. Who was the person who said it? Like religions, I think, I want to say it's Arthur C. Clarke, because everything I think about probably goes Arthur C. Clarke, but someone said, religions don't die, there's just fewer of them, right? There's still people who probably believe in the gods on Mount Olympus. Fewer of them.
I remember the most odd religion or cult I'd ever heard of was one that believed in no sex. And so they were one generation and gone.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's part of the Shakers also. The Shakers believe in celibacy. There's a religion in Vietnam called the Kodai religion that gets most of the teaching is built around the talking board, the Ouija board. There's a lot of there's spiritualism that's still in Central America. There's spiritualism in a lot of places, but it transformed also. And we can go deep into the history and the weeds of it because it moves across all over the place. But when it moves into the South, it turns into evangelicalism. And so we get snake handlers, and speaking in tongues comes from the trans speakers of the movement of spiritualism and from the Shakers, who were kind of the first American mystics. And so the way that it transformed our landscape and our history, even our art, some of the first abstract artists were spiritualist. The movement of Ralph Knights were spiritualist. Books were written. The Book of Ephraim, which won the Pulitzer Prize in the 1970s, it was written using a talking board. There is the first woman, Victoria Woodhull, to run for president was a spiritualist.
On the spiritualist ticket.
Yeah.
Wow.
No, it wasn't on the spiritualist ticket, but she was a spiritualist.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's a large, it really did impact us a lot in a lot of ways. We just don't talk about it because it's kind of an awkward and somewhat taboo part of our history.
Well, I know also it is big in the Mexican or Hispanic culture where they have curanderos. I've talked with some people who have relatives who are into that. And just like voodoo, I guess, in Haiti and different places where they have these different religions and different faiths that are different than
what I would say is in our, quote, civilized world in the United States and Western Europe.
Yeah, and I mean, the westernized world kind of, there becomes a mixture of. It's just like Catholicism, when it moves across the United States, when it moves across the world, it mixes with indigenous cultures. Yeah. And then there's this blend of indigenous practices with kind of these Western practices. And it does take hold there, but it doesn't take hold all over the place because there's already kind of indigenous practices and indigenous ways that people, like ways that they communicated. Mm-hmm. What made the seance and what made the movement of spiritualism so spectacular really was it was a do-it-yourself movement. And it was in a time in the United States where they were trying to create our own identity. So we were trying to create our own sciences. That's a big part. Most people think of it as a faith, and it wasn't a faith. It was a science. And so we have phrenology, bumps on my head mean something. Mesmerism or animal magnetism, hypnosis is what we call it now, right? And so that was a science as well. And so spiritualism is birthed somewhat out of a science. And so that's why when you go back and you read a lot of the texts from in the 1800s and even into the 1920s, spiritualists wanted to be tested because that was going to determine that there was the afterlife and that they could prove what happens, you know, after we cross over. And so, but that also becomes kind of its downfall. And it also becomes an issue with a lot of mediums, especially fraudulent mediums and psychics, because you know, the boldness of being tested means you're gonna get hard scrutiny and oftentimes fail.
So that began, you're saying, in the 1800s, not earlier than that?
So
spiritualism movement.
There's all kinds of roots to the movement of spiritualism. We have Swedenborg, who's over in Europe, who kind of starts producing some philosophy. But the real John the Baptist of the movement of spiritualism is a man named Andrew Jackson Davis, and he's really kind of going out. He's known as the Pococci Seer, and he's going out and really creating a philosophy and the basis of the movement of spiritualism. Mm-hmm. And then in 1848, we get the Fox Sisters, and the Fox Sisters create. That's where I say, like, it really gets their legs at this point, because Andrew Jackson Davis has been around for a few years, but he's just
has a few followers. But
he has a few followers. He's not really getting any kind of traction, but he's out there and he's prophesizing.
But the Fox Sisters, they became popular without actually being on stage, like the Davenport brothers.
Yeah, I mean, the Fox Sisters. So this is where the history. I think this is a big part. So Jake and I, we're very much rooted in the history of American spiritualism seances. We really appreciate it. I mean, last night I was reading a book from 1880 something, and it was just fascinating going through the history and going kind of through that time. But one of the things that's most fascinating, most people get wrong, is that the Fox Sisters, they started the seance. So they're the ones that kind of started the act of the seance and with a call and reply seance. That's simply where you call out to the spirits and you ask for a reply back.
Right? And this was the rapping on the...
This is rapping.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this is where it gets tricky.
Okay.
Because there's in the first seance, so March 31st, 1848, Hydesville, New York, it had been about 16 days that the family had not been sleeping. They were renting this house because they had another house was being built. So they've been renting this house since about December of the previous year of 1847. And so it is this 16 days that they started hearing this kind of rapping, this incessant knocking. Every night around 9 p.m. until like early in the morning, about 6 a.m., they would hear this just knock. Knock, knock, right? And they're losing sleep over this. And it is on March 31st, 1848, that something novel happens as the family is getting ready to go to bed. Margaret Fox is already, Mama Fox is already in her bed. John D. Fox is coming to bed. And the two young girls, they're never mentioned by name in the first seance. And we know this because we have affidavits, and I'll explain that in a second. But they are in a bed, because it's a communal bedroom, right? Mm-hmm. This is back in the
day. Then, sure.
And so they're in their bed, and their cousin, Elizabeth, may also be with them. So it may be three girls that are in the bed, but Katie and Maggie, we know they are probably there. They're never mentioned, but we know they're there. And it is as the knocking begins that the family's like, oh, so another night, that the youngest, so they say the youngest girl, we don't know if this is the cousin or if this is Maggie, but the youngest girl snaps her fingers. And affidavits are collected a few days after this. Margaret Fox says, as soon as the girl's hands went, it replied. And that you get this kind of knock, right? That replies.
I mean, they were asking questions with the snap?
No, they just said follow, and snap their fingers. That's all that happened. The girl snapped her fingers, and then as soon as that snap happened, there's a knock.
Okay,
comes back,
gotcha.
Right?
Nice.
And then the older sister goes. This is Maggie, because Katie's the one that when her hands go. So Maggie, who's about 13 at this time, she claps four times, says follow, and claps four times. And there's four claps, there's four knocks that come back, or raps, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We'll call them raps. And then the mother is the one that takes over. She's the one that really kind of begins the seance. She says, count 10. and there's 10 knocks. And then she says, what are the ages of my children? And it knocks out the ages of all the children. Hmm. I just heard a knock there the room. And then
that's
she
weird.
Says, yeah, yeah. And then she says, she starts asking questions. Are you a spirit? Are you an injured spirit? And then she does the real big novel thing. She says, if I can get my neighbors, will you continue to answer our questions? And there's a yes. Mm-hmm. And then she goes out and she gets their neighbors, the Redfords, and they come over with a bunch of other people and some even fishermen that are on the bank. And the seance continues. And the seance begins, but it's no longer the Fox. The Fox sisters do nothing beyond that. Margaret Fox really does nothing beyond that. It is the neighbors that are holding the seance. And they're hearing these knocks.
So they're the ones asking the questions.
And they start asking questions. And the family at midnight leaves. And the seance continues at about 8 the next morning.
Wow.
Yeah. And so they start to create a system calling out letters, A, B, C, waiting for a knock.
An alphabet.
Calling out numbers, calling out words. And they get the initials CB, and they get some messages that this may be a peddler who was passing through town about 5 years earlier and was murdered by the previous tenant of the home. Mm-hmm. And buried in the basement. So they start digging the basement up.
Wow.
Yeah, they start digging up the basement, and they get it floods, and this is in the morning, and they can no longer dig down there, but they don't find much. And that's it. And that's the first seance. The next day, 300 people came to this home, and they created committees.
How did the 300 people hear about this? I mean, there were already newspapers, or just word of mouth?
There's nothing to do.
Okay.
Right? It's a small town.
Hey, I heard
there's
somebody had a seance. Let's go.
Yeah. And so they're right. They're in Hinesville, which is right outside Rochester. It's real kind of small community.
Rural, sure.
And they go out, and then people just start coming over. Okay. And they start creating committees, and they start trying to find the source of the mysterious noise. And that's where we get this attorney, E. Lewis, that appears, and he collects about 23 affidavits from the witnesses of that weekend, mm-hmm. Describing the events of that weekend, and they cannot find the mysterious noises. And then the noises kind of fade out, and then the whole spectacle kind of fades out. And then it is in 1849 that the Fox sisters reemerge, and now they're on stage in Rochester, and this is where they become the Rochester Knockers, and they start to produce knocks. Hmm. But they were not a part of this first.
So some agent or someone talked with them and said, hey, I think this is an act.
Yeah. The eldest sister really kind of comes in, and she's the one that kind of pushes uh-huh. the sisters to try
to make some money on it.
To make some money, yeah. Okay. And it becomes a tragic story after that. There's some great books on it, but that's the most well-known history of it. The Fox sisters are unreliable. You'll read other books that talk about like that night and all these things that happened, but they're really not a part of it.
Now, Eva Faye was around that time too. Is that
Eva
right?
Or Faye
she came later,
in,
I guess.
Eva Faye comes in much later, yeah. Eva Faye becomes much later. You get people like, who else? Madame Blavatsky, she comes in later. Dee Dee Hume comes right. in later. There's a figure which I think magicians should look into. And I mentioned this in a conversation with you before. Her name's Elizabeth Guppy, and she is in Europe. Robert Pearsall has a book called Table Tippers. And in it, she does this very fascinating thing. They're in this hot room in this upper this house on the second floor. It's super hot. It's a hot summer night in London. Everybody's sweating in there. They're singing songs because it's kind of part of the seance. And they're just waiting, and nothing is happening. And then there's a loud thunk. And in this room that's been inspected, and this person that's been inspected, appears a large block of ice.
Wow.
Yeah. Very much like Max Mellini.
Yeah, so say Mellini.
And this is in about 1886 that
carrying
this happens.
Under the dress between her knees or something. Whatever.
No, I mean, she would have it there for a while, but she's there in this room. It's hot. It's everybody's sweating, and this block of ice appears out of nowhere. Uh-huh. And so, you get all these very interesting figures that are there.
And the Davenport brothers were when?
Davenport brothers come in. They are there about 1886, I believe, 1868. And about 1868, they come in. They produce the spirit cabinet, which becomes a staple mm-hmm. of American seances. And they're still, even seances now, they're still there. Now they're like curtains in the corner. But they create their box. And they're kind of funny because they're kind of a success in the United States. And they're really ripping off of this kind of people from Ohio on what they're doing. But it makes sense. They go to Europe and they get like run off stage twice. Their stuff gets destroyed two times.
Because
and
they're basically
it was so hokey.
Oh.
That, like the audience just wouldn't accept it. So they went up there and just destroyed.
They were fraudulent.
Yeah, they just destroyed all their stuff. Okay. And so then soon afterwards they come on, they're like, hey, we're frauds. But I guess after you've been run out of town and had all your stuff destroyed twice, you kind of
Well, that leads me to the question about how did Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and his wife get so involved then with spiritualism? If it was an American-born thing, how did that get transferred over to England?
It permeates across, and Robert Pearsall talks really great about this in the book of how it transfers over to Europe, but it begins to transfer to Europe. It's an American kind of phenomenon, and it's growing. And then as the exchange of ideas comes over, there are mediums that start to come into Europe, and they start to kind of produce some of these manifestations. And Sir Arthur Conan Doyle becomes involved, just like most people. This is during, he comes in later, and this is after the First World War. His son dies, and so he's grieving, and so he's looking to connect again. You see this with Sir Oliver Lodge, who's another huge proponent of the movement. You see this with a lot of other kind of figures. With the Civil War, it grows really big because people are losing their loved ones, not knowing how to connect.
After there's been a war or some tragic
event, you see a kind of a spike in the movement of the peak of American spiritualism, or just spiritualism and seances in general. I keep saying American spiritualism because that's, you know, it is a largely American kind of phenomenon, but it moves overseas. Europe loves it. We get France, who just really enjoys it, and they're doing table tipping seances and all kinds of very fascinating things. And then it spreads from there. We get a man named Alan Kardec, who goes to South America, and he helps to create a spiritism, and it creates some of the movement down there.
So when Houdini was debunking that, he essentially put a stake in the heart of the spiritualism movement, didn't he?
So there were magicians that did it before.
I assume it was.
So the first magician to come out and try to do anything is Willard of the North. And he decides he's going to figure out the wrappings that the foxes are doing. He doesn't. There's a woman named Norma Culver, who is a cousin, who writes an affidavit. Doesn't explain anything how it's done, just kind of details that she could do and she was taught by it. All the magicians publish this. Even Houdini continues to publish this. No magicians know how the fox sisters made their knocks. And most people say, well, you know, they publicized it in 1888 when they did A Death Blow to Spiritualism in the book, but they don't. They're liars. They're horrible liars, by the way. Anytime they read it, they change their ages when the seance happened. They say they're 5 and 6. They say all kinds of things. They're drunks. They're angry at this point because they were not invited to the big jubilee ceremony by the spiritualists. They get excommunicated essentially because they're such an embarrassment to the movement later on in life that they are just no longer around. In fact, by 1854, a lot of spiritual newspapers are like, oh, that old thing, those knocks, we don't care about that. Have you heard about what these other people can do? And so they really kind of fall out of favor, and they're angry later on in life. And that's when they kind of do the big expose. But even their descriptions, when you read it closely, you'll see that even the way they explain it changes from paragraph to paragraph. And so I don't think they ever really give a thorough explanation. And if you try to do what they do, it doesn't work very well.
The only thing I'd heard was that they were doing it with their toes and some sort of knocking, or that they could, like, you can pop your thumbs, they could pop their toes or something, and the floorboards would resonate that sound.
Yeah, so the floorboards can resonate. So I spent about 3 years looking at all the ways you create these kind of knocks. And there is some things. There's some sources out there. None of it's in the magician's books. Houdini kind of talks about it in his, where he's like, noise in the dark's hard to identify, but it's really this movement of journalists that go out there, and there's some really great material that talks about it. Knocking for the knocks for the knockers, by Chauncey and his brother. There is one once a week. There's all these kind of books and periodicals that you can find some of that information in. But yeah, so what they would do, some of it was the boards, is a movement of toes, but it's not what you think, which is cracking toes. People think like, you know, just like you pop your fingers, which is not it at all. One, if we sat in the dark, and they didn't do their seances in the dark. The fox sisters it wasn't a blackout.
It was full lit.
It was full lit. It could be done in the middle of the day. And so if I'm sitting here and I pop my knuckles, I'm sure you can identify
what it sounds like, sure.
But what they did was novel and nobody else could do. They could produce a double knock.
Wow.
And so that's something that's fascinating. And it changes over time. The descriptions change as you read some of that stuff. But they produce a double knock, and they're not popping their toes, because if you think about popping your toes, popping any joint is a result of nitrogen bubble that accumulates in the joint. Mm-hmm. And then you pop it, it releases it, and it takes about 20 minutes for it to return.
So it can't, like, every 5 minutes or something?
And Norma Culver, and even the Fox sisters talk about, and people who witness them say that she can do 150 a night. Norma Culver, who's the cousin who learns how to do this, can do 50 a night. And what they did is kind of boring it somewhat, is that they would say, you know, you'd ask the question like, what is the age of my daughter who's passed or something? And they would knock out the age. It wasn't like 1, 2 counting and then there'd be knock. It's knock, 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 and it would continue to knock till they got to the number.
To the number.
So that shows that they would have to continuously do this. And there's a couple of different methods. One of the most interesting methods appears again. Magicians love to steal things from the spirituals without giving credit. There is a couple of years ago, FISM, there was the pencil with the heartbeat. Right?
Yeah, really? I do remember that. Yes.
Yeah. It's a great presentation. I think it's a great use of it. And so everybody goes, it's in Tarbell, right? Because everything's in Tarbell.
Everything's in Tarbell.
Yeah. I think even Discovery of Witchcraft is in Tarbell, but it's a Tarbell. But it actually appears, John Animan has it in his one man seance. He talks about it there, but it actually appears before that, it appears in a commissioned investigation called the Cyber Report, and it appears in there, and these spiritualists are doing it, and it may even appear before that, where the Fox sisters may have been using it, where they took a pencil and they had letters on the table, mm-hmm. and they placed the pencil on the letter, and then they would hear a knock from the table.
When it got
and
to the
so
right
they
letter.
Were using the method, and if you know the method, they were utilizing that method
I see.
To create the knocking.
Interesting. So how do seances differ today from where they were before? Or are most of them, like what Jamie Salinas and I do, are recreations of
That gives a big debate here, because a big discussion, I think, more than a debate, because it depends on what lens you're looking at, right?
Good point.
So I think in the realm of the seance itself, so the movement of spiritualism, because there's still camps out there, things change over time, and it deals with fraudulent mediumship. And so a lot of these camps like Lily Dell and Chesterfield, they get exposed and they want to get rid of that. They don't want fraudulent mediumship because they believe—
Who they? Mean the spiritualists.
The true spiritualists.
Okay.
And so they want to weed out
frauds.
And so they no longer allow physical manifestations.
So do they allow magicians to come in and, quote, bust them?
No, it's just people. It's just anybody could bust them. There's some interesting figures, but they get busted really hard and they don't want it anymore because it's starting to splash over the newspaper. It brings a bad light to them. So there's no longer physical manifestations. By physical manifestations, we mean ectoplasm and all kinds of things that occur.
But it was recognized by the government. As I recall, they actually went before the Senate and trying to prove that this is a legitimate religion.
Yes, yeah, it moves into a religion. It goes from a science into a religion.
Yeah.
And even now, it's still kind of in a hazy place. But yes, it moves from a science to a religion somewhat quickly, but really kind of in the 1900s is when they start to, you see it more of a religion. But so you don't see the physical manifestations. A lot of it is kind of mediumship, people kind of feeling and sensing stuff and talking about that. And physical manifestations kind of fall out of favor as well in the 1920s. Malcolm Bird, who was one of the secretaries on the committee that investigated Marjorie Crandon, which I think you're going to speak to somebody about Marjorie Crandon Houdini. He says it best. He says that at the end of the whole investigation, he says, the people these days can no longer just believe something in the dark. They have to see it with their own eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get a kind of a change and you get a better understanding of the scientific world, I think is what's also happening. And so from that point, now magicians kind of can try to continue on the physical manifestation. And this is where I would say things get a little hairy, because I think the magician idea of the seance is somewhat romanticized. But it's a weird thing, because let me start off with this. There's a weird thing between magicians and psychics that only occurs really between magicians and psychics, and probably spurred by Houdini and Maskelyne. He also investigated spiritualist mediumship, but it doesn't happen with card cheats. Card magicians and magicians love a good con man. They love a good card cheat, right?
Yeah, true.
Titanic Thompson. We love Titanic Thompson.
Exactly. Good point.
Right? But we don't like psychics. But we've stolen many. Animan stole so much from the psychics. There's a lot of what we did. And people will ask me sometimes, like, who's the greatest, who's the greatest magician or bizarre magician, right? Let's say not bizarre magician in the act of storytelling, but let's say in the act of the occult.
Not just Tony Andrucci.
I would say Marjorie Crandon.
Marjorie Crandon, okay.
She fooled Houdini.
That's true.
Yeah. And so I think that there's a lot of these spiritualists that were doing things the magicians couldn't figure out or did not care about. And it largely does, some of it deals with gender and some of those other issues, which are kind of gets into some other topics. But they can't, even when Willard of the North looks at the spiritualist, he publishes Norma Culver, her kind of affidavit about knowing how to do the toe knocks. But then he spends a whole chapter being very magician-y, where if he did this and he was creating Knox, he would have these wires underneath the carpet and these electromagnets and a table and a person over in this other room.
Yeah.
And there are these very magician-y kind of answers something, but not what was happening. Because we know that the Fox sisters could do this almost at a moment's notice. We know that other mediums can do this. Last night I was reading a thing about how these not experts took a medium and tied him to a chair, and he was able to like remove his pants and his trousers and his bracers and all kinds of things. And so, you know, you get these people that are doing these very extraordinary things that we don't really know how they're doing because they weren't sharing their secrets. And when they did, they get overutilized by others. You know, Billette readings. We get people like kind of doing one-aheads and Billette stuff. And that is from the spiritualist doing Q&As.
Well, Harry Houdini, though, capitalized on that for a while when he was doing his metamorphosis about do spirits, you know, they thought they changed into spirits and kind of vaporized or materialized through the wood. And then later, I guess he came back and I don't know how he disputed that.
I think I think Harry Houdini could live with a lot of things that he did.
Yeah.
He was a great showman. I think I probably agree with him on Jim Steinmeier. He was a horrible magician.
Yeah.
Great showman. There's another great showman that we don't talk much about, and I encourage people to look him up, and that is Black Herman. Black Herman used to sell out a theater for 4 months in New York that sat 4,000 people.
He was not the guy who was in the box, was he?
He would get buried alive.
Okay.
He blended shamanism and magic. Hmm. And one of the things I loved about Black Herman, and Jake and I have an article that we wrote about him because I think he's a very interesting figure.
1800s or was it during the Civil War?
This is time of Houdini.
Oh, in 1900s.
He would bury himself. So he would be like, let's say he's in Texas because he came through Texas a couple times. Let's say he buried himself in San Antonio on Monday. Mm-hmm. On Tuesday, he'd bury himself in Austin. On Wednesday, he'd bury himself in Dallas. And then on Thursday, he would revive in San Antonio. And on Friday, he revived.
Now, that's interesting.
Yeah. When he died, there were thousands of people that lined up at the train station. And his assistant let people pay him a nickel or a quarter, a dime, to stick a pin in him because people didn't believe he was actually dead.
Hmm.
Yeah. But anyway, I'm digressing. I'm going through a lot of facts here, and you're going to need a lot of footnotes on this conversation. Yeah.
But he never flinched whenever that they would use
a No, because he was dead. Pin? He was actually dead. Okay. So when he died,
slowed his heart.
When he died, nobody thought that he died.
Okay.
Like he actually had a heart attack. So he knew he was dying. He was writing a letter and he goes, I'm dying. And he went to his people. And I think he died on stage. He's one of the few magicians that actually died on stage, mm-hmm. Knowing that he died. And then, but none of the audience knew about this.
Wow.
And so when he died, a train came in and these huge followers and groups of people were there and nobody believed he was dead, that they would stick needles in him to show that he was actually dead.
I think it's absolutely important that magicians who are going to be doing seances today understand and have a full appreciation of at least part, if not all, of what you've been talking about over there. So this way, they're going to be able to present a better seance to their modern audiences today because they're speaking from experience and knowledge of history.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true in a lot of realms, especially like a card sheet shouldn't actually have played poker for a while, right? Hmm. You should know how to play poker. You should know how to know the lingo. You should be able to do that because there's a knowledge that's there. I think Juan Tom Rees talks a little bit about this in The Magic Rainbow. Somebody who knows the history of the trick and knows all that stuff, the audience can feel it. Mm-hmm. Even though you don't have to say it, they can feel it. But I think in this realm, you do need to have, if you're going to do this in the way that Jake and I are doing this, you need to have an understanding of that history because people will come to you with questions and they'll ask you certain things. And we go, we do workshops in occult stores and psychic fairs. We do all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. And me and Jake, we strive. And I think this is where we kind of got off subject here, but we talked about seances now in the work. What Jake and I do is not a magic show. If you came expecting a magic show as a magician, mm-hmm. you will be sorely, sorely disappointed. Mm. We've had magicians who've shown up and they go, there's a bell that was there and it never rang.
Okay.
Why didn't the bell ring or why didn't anything fly around or why didn't like this happen?
Right.
But then they don't realize that the person and people around them that are like not wanting to leave the room because they want to discuss everything that just they experienced. That's the strive for authenticity, right? That's that like we've created the experience that we should create. And so for us, it's a social like experiment, a psychological experiment and a strive for authenticity. And so in part of that is understanding the history and understanding like the movement and understanding the way that people experience, even now, like kind of what are the trends, what's happening, the movement of New Age and all those things I think are important. and having that very planted foot in that realm. The other realm, I think, is a little bit different because I think most magicians and bizarrists, when they do seance work, a lot of times they would do what I'd call spook magic that's seancey. So it would be, I'm going to tell you a story and we're going to talk about Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and Houdini, mm-hmm. and I'm going to do a seance, but it's really a series of ta-da moments or ta-da magic. So an example of a ta-da magic, ta-da moment would be, so we're sitting here, we're going to call the spirits and I'm going to take this handkerchief and I'm going to put it on the table and I'm going to put this cufflink underneath and I'm going to put my fingers on it and notice how it moves under the thing, right? Right. That never happened in a seance room. That's not a seance trick, right? That's a magician trick the magician's created. And it represents something, or
seems spooky.
It seems spooky, right? Or another representation, because I think there's representational magic, like this represents something. Another example of like representational magic or that deals with that is, I've got this vase and I've got a rope and I've got a spirit inside of this vase and I'm going to stick this rope in there.
Right.
Notice how the spirit is holding on to the rope, right?
Right.
That's never happened in history. There's never been a ghost
okay.
who's grabbed onto right. this rope, right?
Right?
That's representational. So I think that kind of falls in the spook magic of like, here are some spooky things that I'm doing. And as soon as you look, it's in there. There's a moment of ta-da.
Right.
And there's a break, there's a pause, right? And then the performer sets it down and then they go on to the next thing. In the seance room, there's no ta-da moments. The ta-da moments are happening all around at the same time because—
And they may or may not happen.
They may not happen. Well, you right. may not even realize that they're happening because it's all experiential, right? And so when I talk about the move for authenticity, what it does is it requires us to remove the magician, the lens of the magician, and it makes us focus on the audience because the act of, this is something fascinating, and there's some good recent essays written on this by a couple of professors and other people, is what is the difference between a magician and a psychic or a medium?
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to take a Peter Lamont idea, which I think is a great example, and then I'm going to take an essay that's on this. So Peter Lamont, I think, and I'm going to butcher this, so I apologize. I think he has a thing where he says, like, you know, give a magician a piano and a psychic a piano, and the magician will throw a sheet on the piano, cause it to float, it'll play Beethoven, pull the sheet off and—
Disappear.
It disappear, right?
Right.
But the psychic only needs to make one note play. Hmm. Which one's more powerful to the audience? Right? This one's more amazing, flying around and playing Beethoven. It's amazing. It's right. beautiful, right? But making that one note play without touching it, mysterious.
Interesting.
Right? And so that's where that's subtlety—
That's a different wow. That is
It's a
clear.
Very different wow, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when we look at that, we have to look at what are the roles that we play too as the facilitators. So Jake and I are facilitators in what we do, and nothing deals with us. It's never about us. Nothing happens in our hands. Everything is experienced by our sitters, and they're the ones that we focus on because they're the ones experiencing it. And so, and that plays the role of the magician and the psychic. The magician wants control. Mm-hmm. The magician makes the magic happen. It makes the moment happen. But the psychic is a passive role. It's something coming through them.
There is yet a third person, and that would be like the ghost hunter, the person who's a skeptic and kind of looking at something. I mean, that's the way, because we had looked at those kinds of things also mm-hmm. and decided we don't want to be a magician because then people are going to think it's a magic show.
Yeah.
We don't want them to applaud and laugh, number one.
Yeah.
So we don't want to be a medium who after the show, they're going to come to us and say, can you tell me about my Aunt Edna, you know, or whatever.
Yeah.
I'd rather say, okay, look, we've got this EMF meter and we're using these other mm-hmm. kinds of heat generating mm-hmm. things, electronic equipment, basically. And we're just as interested in finding out whether there is anything real as you are, of being, again, a ghost hunter, because it's been very popular in the zeitgeist.
Yeah. I mean, yes, I think the ghost hunting was very popular. And you are right in that, you know, I think you have to decide what you're going to be.
That's
and
exactly
who you're
right.
going to be, because you have to live with that.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us, I am the skeptic, and I raise my hand. Who does not believe in this? And I raise my hand, and I say I don't believe in this, and I explain why to the audience. It's because my interest is not in whether or not this is real; it's how we experience it.
Right.
And Jake is agnostic to it. He believes, and he allows that. But both of us have a very firm belief that it is about creating that authentic moment and allowing people to experience mm-hmm. that. And so that's what we do. And so there are ways that this changes the way that we approach the way that we look at creating that experience from tricks to other kinds of methods. And when I talk about other methods, what I mean is truly recreating the conditions and the space for people to experience it. And so this could be a lot of things. So there's a really long analogy, but the idea that I best do this is you take an apple, you crack it open, and you put one seed in the ground outside, you put another seed indoors.
Okay.
And you create the same conditions indoors, outdoors. If water, it rains two sun. Inches, it rains inside. Okay. Whatever the temperature is, you're doing all of these things. You're creating the same conditions. Uh-huh. Those trees grow. Mm-hmm. They both create apples. Is there a difference between either apple? The one that was created by the conditions that you provided or the ones that are outside? They're still the same apple. Mm-hmm. The tree still experiences the same things to create this apple, right? Mm-hmm. And so the tree is really the experience of the audience, and what they produce out of it, what they get out of it, are still very much the same. Hmm. And so how do we look at that? So when we put together seance, and some of this is why magicians get very sad about what it is that we're doing, and they go in there expecting, you know, things flying around, a light appearing above our head, and a 3-foot woman coming in yelling, "Don't go in the light," right? That's very dramatic and that's very theatrical. But what we're looking really for is, how do I create that sensation that we've all had of waking up in the middle of the night and knowing, feeling, or sensing mm-hmm. that there is somebody in your home, in your room, or at the foot of your bed?
It's at the foot of your bed, right.
We've all been there. You've experienced that. How do we do that again? But how do we do that in the seance room?
Is there always something that happens at one of your seances? Or can you say sometimes nothing happens, people come and go, and we say, well, sorry, the spirits didn't visit us tonight.
Yeah, sometimes it's sometimes there's always something that'll happen. And that's because I would say we play casino odds on the conditions. The house has the odds. We don't know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. I have no idea. Once the seance begins.
You create that experience.
Once the seance begins, Jake and I have no control over what happens.
I see.
We don't know anything that's going to occur.
Do you light candles, spread some salt around the table, do all that kind of thing? Or what do you do?
No. So I can give kind of a brief explanation. So we talk about the history. We start off with the history. We do a little kind of not a Q&A, but like a little just talk in the beginning before everything begins, just to kind of get people feel comfortable. We talk about the history. We set expectations.
Of seances like we've just discussed.
Yeah. But more not condensed that. And not as like meandering right. through a bunch of different places. And then we talk about what to expect, because I think that's really important. And because we're not doing a magic show, and this is not a... This isn't a movie, so this isn't dolls are going to run across the floor.
Do you say that mm-hmm. to them? This is not a magic show. It's not a movie.
Oh, this is not a magic show. This is not a movie.
Okay, interesting.
There'll be no magic tricks. Mm-hmm. There are no magic tricks. This is not a movie. This does not look like the movies. What we expect is similar to experiences that we've all had, and we talk about some of those experiences. And they're very small and subtle things, because that's really kind of what happens largely in the seance room when you're not attempting to do physical manifestations. Uh-huh. It's small things, because what we're attempting to do is a call and reply. Spirits, if you're out there and you can hear me, give us a sign. And then we sit here, just mm-hmm. like we're sitting now.
We wait.
Spirits, if you're out there and you can hear us, give us a sign. And so we do a little bit of a guided meditation and bring people kind of into a place of calm and relaxation, which helps, because you have a lot of anxiety. You don't know what's going in. So let's calm you down. And so now you can experience the room in a different place.
Do you have props or anything that's out there to begin with that the spirits can touch, move something?
We have some items, but nothing really of note. A lot of what we get is going to be from the experience of the room itself.
Okay.
And so, we call out letters A, B, C, D. Mm-hmm. We call out numbers. We call out words.
You don't use a Ouija board or anything?
We don't use a talking board, but we do have a talking board workshop. Mm-hmm. And the reason why I don't like the talking board, Jake and I have discussed this, is because it's on a flat plane. Mm-hmm. Not everybody, all the sitters can see it.
Yeah, usually you have about 20 to 30 people in a sitting?
Yeah, anywhere from 20, it could be up to 75, but usually we try to keep it to
pretty
about 30.
Intimate, yeah.
30 is a good number. Once you get really big, people start to break off, and there's some things that we do to manage that, but talking boards are a thing we typically don't have, because, again, even if there's 30 people in the room, you really can't see, and it's dark, you can't see what's on the board.
Okay.
Right. And so you have to trust. And if you get somebody, as we have all had, you know, anybody who has a background in magic knows, you get a volunteer, they come up, they don't say anything. They don't know what to expect. They don't know what to do. If you've never had a talking board before, you don't know what to do.
True.
And so that is a whole management thing that takes time. So we don't have a talking board.
Is it a red light or a darkened seance?
A darkened seance, but it's not a blackout seance. Okay. And it's not a red light seance. I think Terry Tyson does a really nice red light seance mm-hmm. which is more of a spirit contact. So showing that there's spirits that are there.
Right.
And I think the big thing now is the black rock.
Yes.
So he does. He does that.
Right.
We don't.
That's pretty
don't do that.
Creepy. I mean, you just stare at it for so long.
Yeah, he stared at it. Yeah. I would say most of what we're creating are conditions. When I say conditions, I mean like aprophenia. So aprophenia is the human's brain to create pattern or meaning out of randomness, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Creating mm-hmm. shapes out of shadows.
Right.
So the creation of aprophenia, the creation of other sensory kind of things that are there that you sense and that you feel. And so people will experience something in the room. Now, sometimes people talk, sometimes people don't. And that's not up to us.
That's what I was wondering when you were talking earlier about how that those early seances had gone on until late in the morning. Mm-hmm. Obviously, they weren't going on and continuing to ask questions to the dead. They probably were just talking amongst themselves saying, did you think you understand this or what happened? You know, they're trying to interpret. And so it was their experience to be probably talked about for hours later.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And that's a big, like Jake and I, one of the big motivations that we have is actually people to come talk about it afterwards.
Sure.
So we have a whole debriefing part where people get to sit in the room and talk about it. And then after that, people just sit around and they'll just outside the seance room just sit and talk about their own experiences and their own kind of stories about the supernatural. We find that a lot of the people who come to our sitting, a lot of our sitters are, I call them occult curious. They're people who they're not, you go in their home, they're not gothy. They don't have all this occult stuff. They're people that are really genuinely interested in it, but maybe they don't tell their friends about it. They want their interest in, so they come. And so, and we have a lot of repeat people that come back over and over again. And we've done stuff for the Spiritualist Church. We've done talks for them. We've done workshops on a variety of things. But again, it's different. It's a very different experience than what you would get from a typical kind of magic forward kind magic of thinking.
I interrupted your flow when you were talking about the process of what that you're doing. Instead of candles and salt and everything that you're saying that you just have... What, you invite people to?
Yeah, we may have cards with letters on it. We may have words. We might have bottles that are just in there that people are holding.
No pendulums or anything?
No pendulums. I'm not a big fan of pendulums.
Okay.
I've got a lot of the stuff, and this is in sincerity. When Jake and I looked at doing this, we, in the striving for authenticity and looking at it, we really threw out, I read all the invocations. I read Spirit Theater. I read the Seance magazines, read all of those and just said, none of this is what we're looking for. And so then it became looking at research papers, psychology research papers, looking at literature from the 1800s.
Interesting.
Looking at papers on all kinds of different things, right? So, and then looking at how can we apply these things? Like I said, we're creating the conditions in the room, and the conditions outside are just like the conditions on the inside. And so how do we create those? Mm-hmm. And so this could be, somebody who is interested in seances and taking a very different approach, and kind of the approach that we're looking at when I say striving for that authenticity is looking at stuff like phantom border disorder, looking at kind of other really interesting studies. We do a thing on the talking board, a workshop on the talking board, and it's a really great workshop. And it's really about the games that we play and creating a sense of community. And that's really the purpose of it. But it's all built off of a research paper from 2017 on how people use the talking board and the way that it works. And this isn't just the ideometer or ideomotor effect, however you want to pronounce that. Mm-hmm. This is really kind of like, how are people using it? What are their eyes are doing physiologically? What's occurring internally and mentally, what's occurring, and then how do we replicate that, right? How do we recreate that to people who have this experience? Hmm. And now they're not sitting there getting gibberish, but they're really getting something that's meaningful. We do one on psychometry, and that's another thing, the act of psychometry that's done in the realm of spiritualism or even the occult is very different than the act of psychometry amongst magicians. Magicians, what they love to do is basically put something in a bag and I'm going to tell you who it belongs to.
Right.
This belongs to you. This belongs to you.
Yeah.
But the true act of it in spiritualism and in the occult is I'm going to hold something and I'm going to tell you something about yourself. Right. So like, Scott, you give me something and I hold on to it and I go, there's a memory attached to this. And it was when you were a child, and when you were a child, blah, 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 blah. Right. And so now I'm like, actively doing psychometry, right? I'm getting something from it. Very post.
Completely different.
Yeah.
Between the two.
Yeah. And so that's what we talk about striving for authenticity. That's what we're striving for, right? But then in our workshop, the question that we look at and the design of it is, how do I get you to experience it? I'm not going to demonstrate a single bit of psychometry, but you, Scott, when you leave, you'll go, how did I know that?
Right.
How did I sense that? And so how do we create that? And that is also like how we're looking at different kind of papers and looking at the ways that people think and the way that people move and then striving for that authenticity.
And in identifying where you're going to be holding seances, mm-hmm. and we were talking about doing this a lot of different places around the country, and here in Austin, I know you've got a place that is, what is that called, the pony barn?
It's
or
a shed. It's a literal shed, a pony shed.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm not going to church it up. Yeah, it's a shed. Yeah.
Try and find places that are kind of creepy-ish?
So this is actually a good story. So when Jake and I first started, we went around to a bunch of theaters in Austin. We said, we've got like this idea. We'd like to do a seance. And
you weren't going to have it like in a hotel ballroom, right?
No, we're going to do it in a hotel ballroom. We wanted to sort of start small. Yep. And we have a very revival kind of feel to the way that we dress. And we have real antiques. Everything is real antiques. We have all mm-hmm. kinds of stuff. And so we had a feel that we wanted to go for and a vibe. And we wanted to present this in some interesting places. So we went to a lot of theaters. And they would say, this sounds like a really great idea. Send us an email on Monday. We sent that email, never heard
anything. Nothing, right.
Nothing. And then Jake was eating dinner, Patrizzi's, which is best Italian restaurant in Austin, and comes to me and goes, Albert, there's a shed at this place called The Vortex. I want to go down there and see if we can use the shed. I think it'll be perfect for the seance. And so I show up with him and talk to the manager of The Vortex, the theater, because there's a theater inside. Huh. There's a full theater, plays and everything. Huh. And we've done some talks in there. We've done some workshops and stuff for them. But not at this point. They didn't know who we were. Mm-hmm. And we take the person out there, and Jake's like, we've got this idea, blah, blah. She's like, you know, that sounds really great. You know, send us an email on Monday. And Jake goes, No, we don't want your theater. We want that shed. And the shed is about like 14 feet by 16 feet. Uh-huh. It's not a very big shed. And it's just a literal metal shed.
It's a with larger windows, outhouse.
With windows all around. Yeah. And she was like, you know, like what? And Jake was like, oh, we want the shed. And she's like, okay, sure. And he's like, perfect. How much for it? She didn't even know. She was like,
take it.
Just give us a donation. Yeah. And he goes, cool. Put us on the calendar now. And so that's how we started. And
that's back in 2016.
That was in 2016, the end of January of 2016. We had no idea. Jake wanted to charge nothing. I said, we got to charge something because people won't show up. So we charged $5 for people mm-hmm. to come in. And we sold out that entire weekend. So then we came back.
How'd you promote that? Just social media?
Yeah. So we did social media. We did a couple billings. We did a couple things in the newspaper. Like just kind of like, hey, we're just doing this thing.
Right.
Again, we had no confidence in anybody be interested in this and that it was even worthy of anything. And it's in January, right?
Yeah.
And so we sold out. So then we did it in March. And this time we put a little more effort into it. We did some more. We put some information out in the newspaper. We did a couple interviews. We put posters all around town. And we sold out again. And so then we did it in July, in the middle of the summer.
Wow.
And we sold out then. And we did, that year, we probably did almost 100, I'd say about 80 to 100 seances that year.
Wow. Now, you were also doing them though in San Antonio and San Marcos.
So we do them in San Antonio, San Marcos, Houston, Corpus Christi, Port Aransas. Yeah, we do them all over. So once we started kind of going out and doing this and people started seeing what is it we're doing and how different it was. Mm-hmm. Because it's a big part is people will come and say, oh, we thought this was going to be a play or oh, we thought this was going to be a magic show.
Right.
My favorite was these two young girls that go like, we didn't know what this was going to be. We didn't know if this was going to be a magic show or a theater or if it was just two weird guys in a shed. And I was like,
well, you got what? The last one right. That's, yeah, that's right. The shed. Right. Yeah. No air conditioning, that's I guess. Right.
Yeah. I guess it's climate control, wherever the climate is outside.
Okay.
Controls. We've tried to put air conditioning in there.
Yeah.
But, you know, we've done it. We put out revival kind of fans, like, uh-huh. like you're going tent church.
Right.
We've put a heater in there because we've done it in.
Oh, yeah. In winter.
Winter. We've done it in winter. Mm-hmm. We've done all kinds of things. But now we have, you know, we got a couple museums that we go to. Mm-hmm. We have every year the same people that want us back every year to come back and do it. We do a Victorian mansion in San Antonio.
Do you have the same charge for each of the places where you're performing? In other words, how much do you charge? Is it 40, 60 bucks or something?
So it depends. It runs the gamut, anywhere from like 35 to 100.
Okay. I just wondered if it was all the same across the board, but no, it depends upon the venue.
Yeah, it depends on the venue. And so that's a big part is what is the venue? So if it's a venue that wants us, it's what do they feel like is mm-hmm. the price point that they want? Mm-hmm. If it's us, we're thinking about what it is that we think would be a good price point for what it is that we're doing. So like if you're in a metal shed, you're not going to pay $100 to sit in a metal shed in the middle of the summer, right? But if I'm in a Victorian mansion with just it's littered with Victorian artifacts,
right,
you're going to pay a little bit more.
That makes sense.
And so we leave that up to them. The experiences may change, but they're pretty much the same. And by that, we mean we may pull out our giant antique spirit cabinet. Mm-hmm. And we may have a couple other things that we bring there. But really, it's kind of that the experience itself is going to be that. And I say the same. When I say the same, I want to also really much point out, if you came to two seances back to back, they'll be vastly different.
Even in the same location,
if you came, you'll hear the same history, you'll hear the same expectations, you have the same guided meditation. But the moment the seance begins, I don't know what's going to happen. Jake does not know what's going to happen. None of us know what's going to happen.
You just kind of open the door and see what's coming in.
And exactly. And I think that lends that authenticity. Mm-hmm. And people can grab our stuff. People have grabbed our stuff. People have taken things apart to see what's, if there's something going on. Mm. We allow it. Go ahead. You can touch it because there is nothing.
Right.
That is there. And so
it's not magic gimmickry. It's not a magic thing.
Yeah. And it's just, it's really is about that, creating that experience. And I think, and being on the podcast, sitting here talking to you, it's really, what is the strive for magicians? To create an experience, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's what we're really doing. And we're using kind of the way that we experience, or I would say, Jake would have a very different philosophical viewpoint than me, but I would say we're very much using the way that we experience the world as a way of producing that in the room.
Right. Yeah. Well, as we wrap up,
yep.
I can't believe how quickly this went.
Yeah, all this,
it was phenomenal. Thank you very much. And I appreciate all the info that you had shared. And I think a lot of people who are listening are going to be getting a lot of out of this as well. That it may be kind of late right now for them to try to do any seance this year, but they've got a year to work on all this kind of stuff. So the name of my podcast is called The Magic Word. And I always like to ask what it is that is your magic word for this Halloween season.
What is my magic word for this Halloween season?
I don't mean like abracadabra.
Abracadabra.
Yeah.
I would say give us a sign.
Give us a sign.
Yeah. If you're out there and you can hear us, give us a sign. So that's something that we say a lot. If you're out there and hear us, give us a sign. So give us a sign.
Yeah.
I think for us as people, we're always searching for meaning.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that whether in the seance room, whether you are a person who is a believer or skeptic, there's always that search for meaning and purpose. And I think that's what we're looking for, is those signs. In the very beginning, Jake says, how many of y'all here believe in the supernatural? Raise your hand. How many of y'all have experienced it? How many of y'all believe it's all hokum? Mm-hmm. And then he says, it doesn't really matter. The real question is, how many of y'all
will keep an open mind,
wonder what happens to us after we die?
Oh, and everybody raise their hand then. Sure.
And that's the sign, right? what happens to us? What's the purpose?
So people can go to austinseance.com and see Jay Cordero or you.
Yep.
And so I appreciate very much you being my guest here this week. This has been great, Albert.
Thank you. Yeah.
So, So for the Magic Word podcast, that was Albert Lucio. This is Scotty out.
That was an all over the place conversation.
It was.
Yeah.
Thank you, Albert, for being my guest this week on the magicwordpodcast.com. What a lesson that we got there. Wow. Again, I kind of feel like I went to school and was just sitting in the lecture hall listening. And I hope that you got a lot out of this particular episode as well. Very good. Thank you, Albert. And I look forward to actually sitting in on one of your seances sometime here in the very near future. I want to thank everybody also for coming in from week to week and listening to this podcast. And also, I have started something about 4 months ago that's called The Magic Whisper, which is a short video, kind of what's happening behind the scenes. In other words, things that are off the microphone or some things that have been told to me or some things that I kind of hear that are little tidbits here and there, just basically magic news bits, if you will. And if you have anything like that that you can send to me, that'd be great. You can send it through Spreaker, which if you go to the magicwordpodcast.com there, you'll see a little link that if you click on that, you can leave that. That way we have a voice imprint of some little secret you want to share with us, a little news bit. And if you want to send an email or a text, that's fine. Send it to scott@themagicwordpodcast.com. I would like to know what's going on out there, and I'd be glad to share your secrets on the Magic Whisper. And that way we kind of let the rest of the magic community know what's going on behind the scenes and out in our particular unique community. And you can listen to the Magic Whisper on my YouTube channel. Just go to YouTube and type in Texas Magician and you can find me, or look for Scott Wells and you'll find the Magic Whisper. They run anywhere from about 5 to 12, 13 minutes. It depends upon what we have to say each week. Another thing, too, if you would, please, if you've not yet subscribed to the Pod Letter, if you'll go to the magicwordpodcast.com, while you're there, there should be a little pop-up
that will say, subscribe to our pod letter. Please do. That keeps you up to date on who's going to be on from week to week, and also some suggestion from the archives. And if we have contests, or when we do have contests, you are the first one to know who are subscribers to the pod letter. One final thing, if you can help us financially, that'd be great. We would appreciate that. We haven't had anybody new recently who has donated or pledged financial support to help us, but you can do that through PayPal or Patreon.com. More information, of course, at themagicwordpodcast.com. And if you can't help us financially, you can always give us a 5-star review. I understand there are at least 20 different platforms where people can listen to podcasts and also then leave reviews and also post comments. So if you can give us a 5-star review with some nice comments on whatever platform you listen to this podcast, that will help our podcast grow. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to look for the meaning in life. And if you're out there, just give us a sign. And I guess that would also relate to, if you're out there and you're listening, drop us a magic whisper. So this way we have some news bits to report. This is Scotty out.